handle the truth.
The Denise Simon Experience. The Truth Matrix. Vetting, exposing, drilling down to the truth.
Rolling Thunder, this is Hitman, see you at over.
Hitman, this is Rolling Thunder, see you at out.
The Denise Simon Experience. Exposing politics, lies, demagoguery, spin, fraud.
Grid to suppress, Mike Charlie, 435-921. Grid to mark, Mike Charlie, 473-989, out.
Promoting individual situational awareness. Question, probe, notice, ask why.
Mark smoke on the deck, two rounds AGBT. TOT 5-3.
And now, the Denise Simon Experience.
Hey there, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Denise Simon Experience, and thanks so much for tuning in to WDDQ Talk 92.1. We're so happy that you're along for the ride. Daniel Street has been with us before, but he's agreed to share some time with us to talk about Trump trial that's going on in New York. I think it's going to last for several weeks. And Daniel is also an attorney and the proud author of Fake News Exposed. Daniel, thanks for carving out some time to be with us. We appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad to be here, and thank you for having me on.
We often hear that the justice system in the United States works. And I think there was a time when it did. I'm not so sure about it anymore, especially when the cases, and there's been a pile of them in the last 10 years or so, are just political. You've got agencies like the EPA, they're suing landowners, for water infringements when there's not any water on their property. You know, there might be a puddle after a rain, but that's about it. You got cases where the government is suing and taking people's contents out of safe deposit boxes with no search warrants. I mean, I can go on and on and on. I would say here, with this Trump trial in the hush, are we calling it the hush money case? Is that what we're calling it?
That's what most people call it.
Okay. I know that the Trump legal team is getting a lot of solicited and unsolicited legal advice from corners all over the country of people that were former federal prosecutors, trial lawyers, constitutional professors, and those kinds of things. And I'm happy for that. So I don't think that his legal team necessarily needs a lot of legal advice here at this point. I think they probably hit the saturation point. But I think what necessarily may be happening, and I'm just guessing here, Daniel, so you're going to have to straighten me out. And that is that how they make the arguments and the inventory list that they're keeping on why the case was, if he's found guilty, will go to appeals. So break that down for me, if you will, and step on my toes if I said something stupid.
Well, first of all, you're right about the Trump legal team getting on all of his cases, actually, getting an enormous amount mm-hmm. of, 2 cents worth from everybody. And I tell you, they've gotten it from me. I try to take a little different approach. I don't tell or even suggest to Trump's lawyers about how they might do X, Y, or Z. But what I try to do is just break down what's going on so people can have a better understanding of it. I think that from what I've seen so far, President Trump's legal team is doing a good job of developing the issues for appeal. Because, listen, yes. the reality is, and I would love to tell people different. I wish I could tell people different. Between the Manhattan DA And there, it's collaboration with the United States Department of Justice under the Biden regime. And this district judge, which they call a Supreme Court judge, actually the district court in New York is called the Supreme Court. This is one big setup to get a conviction on President Trump. And I would love to tell people that wasn't the case. But you're talking about how you feel like the legal system in this country is dysfunctional. And I tell you, there's a lot of lawyers like me that agree with that. This prosecution is an abomination for a host of reasons. And right now, President Trump's team is hoping for a Hail Mary. They're hoping to get a win, but they're really building their record for appeal. And they've been doing that every day and working towards it very diligently.
Well, there's a whole lot of people in New York that have been indoctrinated to hate Trump. And I think if you ask them individually, why don't you like Trump? They probably couldn't give you a real answer. Their knee-jerk reaction would be to say that he's racist. Yet we can probably, you and I, Daniel, can sit here and list all the reasons why he's not. But, you know, they haven't been introduced to those facts or have conveniently forgotten them. So when it comes to a jury, it's almost as though his defense team is going to have to teach the jury and teach the judge how wrong they are with these prejudicial conclusions that they already have. So it's going to be the art of the argument. Is that right?
Well, I mean, to a large extent, I think that what people have to keep in mind is that this judge is circumscribing or constricting or limiting the ability of President Trump and his legal team to defend this case. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. But one thing I wanted to point out, we're talking about jury selection in this case took a week. You know, the original panels of jurors coming in, on average, were excused. Half of them were excused because they said they just said they couldn't be fair. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, I can't be fair to this defendant. I'm going to tell you, I've been a lawyer for 27 and a half years. People are loathe to admit they can't be fair. It's an incredibly difficult admission to get out of someone when you're selecting a jury. It's just against human nature. Person, well, I'm fair. I'm always, everybody thinks they're fair. You know, so that is the greatest proof, I think the best proof, the most persuasive proof that any person could ever conjure that this case needed to be moved to another venue that was not so antagonistic towards the defendant. You know, so it's that issue, I think I know that Trump's team has run that up to the Court of Appeal. I was unable to determine before the call today whether the Court of Appeals ruled on that or not. But they did previous to trial, but after jury selection being so difficult. Remember, there were two people seated on this jury who, after being seated, came back and got removed. One of them said, look, I can't be fair. I was lying to you, basically. And then another one had some criminal background had not been disclosed. And the DA's office went and found out about it. So, and look, I got to tell you, that's another thing. It just doesn't happen. People get seated on a jury and before the trial starts get removed because they can't be fair, even though they said they could. You know, I mean, this is extraordinary. And that's before you get to
the opening
anything
argument
that has to do with, anything that has to do with the merits of the case. I mean, that which is another thing. This case has no merit. None. Zero. Mm-hmm. Absolutely none. So, you know, one of the very first things you said was, about this case being called the hush money case. I call it the shakedown case because that's really what was going on. President Trump was being shook down, or people acting on his behalf, if you will. You know, we have the one guy who was the former doorman got paid $30,000 about a completely, utterly, totally false story about a love child. You know, so this was President Trump being shaken down. This is the shakedown case. That's what I call it.
Do you expect other jurors are going to be eliminated here, say, within the first week or so?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised.
I wouldn't either.
But that's not that unusual. It maybe not in the first week. But if you get a trial that lasts 6 weeks, like this one's projected to be 6 to 8 weeks, although frankly, I don't know how in the world you get this little case to be 6 to 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But usually what will happen, if for no other reason, there are personal circumstances that will arise. So you've got the jurors and you've got the alternate. There will be a couple of people excused, but most of the time it would be maybe somebody got sick or they have a child get sick or they had something bad happen. Will additional facts come to light that disqualify a juror? I can only speculate about that, but I wouldn't be surprised. This is another thing that people need to keep in mind. The judge ordered that the identity of the jurors be hidden. So these are, you're not your typical situation where the names of the jurors. He employed the methodology that was used, is typically used in a mob trial to stop the mob from trying to be able to influence people. From witness tampering. So now I think the jurors might be a little comforted by it because, the media would be doing everything in the world to tamper with this jury if their identities were known. We've seen that in other cases. And this is one of those rare cases where I might say it might actually work in President Trump's favor for the simple reason that, the left would be threatening to cancel these people and everything else if they voted to acquit, either way, that's still an extraordinary situation that we just don't see except in very limited cases, usually involving, organized crime.
Let's talk about the judge. The judge with, I would think, ethically should have recused.
Yes.
And mostly because of he made campaign contributions, but he has a daughter who's actually, I think I saw that has raised over $1 million. Now, I don't know that number to be accurate or not. Because she's a political operative and she's been fundraising off of this case. So that into itself would tell me that he should recuse. So would that be Daniel Street, one of the top reasons for an appeal? The judge himself?
Sure, without a doubt. And another point too, is I believe it's the judge's wife that used to work for Letitia James, who's the attorney general.
An intern, yes.
Yeah, so you've got that also. And look, first of all, the simple fact of the matter is that this is a case of historical significance. And there shouldn't be any question about the impartiality of the judge, period, none. There should be no discussion about whether or not the judge is impartial. This judge has never been impartial in this case. And I'll give you a for instance. From the very beginning, when Trump's first appearance in court, the judge was all over Trump about the things he had said in public. And not one word from the judge about Alvin Bragg's completely unethical press conference and all the misinformation that Alvin Bragg has spread. The prosecutor has a constitutional obligation to protect the fair trial rights of the accused. That's across the board. That's a federal constitutional obligation. And Alvin Bragg has made one public statement after another, prejudicial to President Trump's fair trial rights. And this judge hasn't said a word about it. And when you looked at the judge, when he released his questionnaire that he was going to go through with all the jurors, go back and read it. All kinds of questions to try to uncover anybody that might be remotely favorable to Trump. Not one question as to whether anybody, any prospective juror, had heard or was familiar with any of the prejudicial statements made by the prosecutor. So this whole thing's been cooked up. And in my opinion, look, I've written about this in my Substack. There's a dozen reasons why this bogus prosecution should have been dismissed. They're all good reasons. And this judge went right down the line and overruled or rejected all of them.
Did I hear Mr. Daniel Street late last week where each team, the prosecution team and the defense team, has to share their evidence or their witness list with the other side of the aisle, and that there has been a ruling that that the prosecution does not have to do it in this case because Trump can't be trusted. Did I see that?
You saw a report about the prosecution team asking the court to limit,
yes,
in some manner in which their obligation to disclose the order of the witnesses they were calling.
The order,
yeah,
of the witnesses.
It pertained to the order of which, like who they were calling first and who they're going to call next and all of that. That's what I'm familiar with. Now, one thing we have to keep in mind, and that your audience needs to know, it's difficult to get information about this particular case. And the reason for it is that, you know, TV cameras are not allowed in the courtroom, and, audio recording equipment's not allowed from media in the courtroom, and access to the online legal filings is very limited in New York. So it's not like, you know, if there's an appearance in one of the federal cases, well, anybody can go on public access to electronic court records or PACER and download the briefs that are filed in the court orders, except for the ones under seal. But you can't do that in New York. So most of the time we're getting this information, we're getting it from reporters, and who in many cases aren't lawyers, who come out and say, hey, this is what the judge said and whatnot. And it's very frustrating to me because it's a very difficult case for me to keep up with as carefully as I would like to.
Something tells me that every law school professor from here on out, when this case is over with, it will be probably the number one studied case in Law 101.
Might be.
For so many reasons. Executive privilege, the fact that the statute of limitations came and went. You took misdemeanors and elevated them to felonies. I mean, there's all kinds of sketchy shadiness that's happened here. And law schools should have a field day. I mean, you could probably teach one whole year's worth of law, regardless of what kind of law it is, just off of the genesis of this case to the end of this case. That's kind of how I see it.
Yeah, well, I think it would be a case study.
Yes.
And should be a case study in how a prosecutor should not handle a case, how a prosecutor's office should not conduct itself, and how
a court, or the Department of Justice, or the Southern District of New York, or Alvin. Yeah, I mean,
that's right. Should not. And look, and let's take another thing. Look, this was such a targeted operation that one of the prosecutors who was working on the case, or two of them actually, resigned, and then one of them wrote a book. And in that book, he describes how, hey, this may have been what Stormy Daniels was doing, may have been extortion. And he writes about it in his book, about the theory he was trying to get the DA to follow, to prosecute Trump for that, not to prosecute Stormy Daniels, you know? And it's just it's unfathomable. But the one point I always want to make with people about this case is this is, and there's, look, it's so much to unpack. We could literally talk about it for an hour and a half. So I try to hit the high point that shows everybody this is bogus. And here's what it boils down to. These charges against President Trump are based on allegedly falsifying business records. And both the misdemeanor statute and the felony statute require that not only that there be a false business record, but that the defendant caused it to be made, but that it be made with the intent to defraud. And there was no intent to defraud. And New York case law has held, and I cited it in my Substack, that intent to defraud is the intent to deprive someone of something of value. And when President Trump's legal team filed their motion to dismiss in this case, the judge, the Manhattan DA's office argued, oh, they were attempting to defraud the people of the United States.
And, of what?
And the judge said, oh, that's good enough, of nothing. It was total nonsense. How do you defraud somebody with a private business notation made after the election? That's all about their claim that it's election interference. You know, And so the simple fact of the matter is that when I talk about this case, I always tell people, look, even if there were incorrect business records, which I would disagree with that, but
sure,
let's assume that were true. They weren't made with the intent to defraud anyone, period. And so, you know, that's the main thing about this that's so frustrating, is that one time after another, I mean, in instance after instance, episode after episode, these legal theories are being stretched and strained and extended beyond anything they were ever intended to, all in an effort to get Donald Trump.
Well, when you say that nobody was defrauded, did same thing with the Letitia James case.
That's right.
Because nobody in the state of New York was defrauded either, right?
That's correct. No one on planet Earth was a victim in that case. No one. A lot of the banks were from Europe, you know, but yeah, there were no victims. Now you're referring to the civil fine case, mm-hmm. the $465 million judgment now when you add legal interest to it. Yeah, all of those banks, all of those loans were repaid, I mean, were paid back on time with interest. All the lenders made money. There were no victims, period. Even if you assume that, and this is a huge assumption because that's another case that was ridiculous. Even if you assume that the valuation that President Trump and the Trump organization made of these various different assets were incorrect, they were inflated, there's still no victim. There's nobody. The court couldn't order restitution because nobody lost any money.
Daniel Street, if you're sitting at a round table at a bar with 10 other lawyers, are you having the same conversation with 10 other lawyers as you're having with a burned out tennis player that is a radio show host?
Well, you'd be
aim
amazed
so?
how similar the conversations are, because I will tell you that the vast majority of lawyers, even the ones who are concerned about this, are so busy, they don't get to look at this very carefully. And so I do this in my spare time. When I say I do this in my spare time, all the writing I do and all of the legal analysis I do and the research, I do this late at night when everybody else went to bed, you know. And so a lot of lawyers are so busy. They're like, Street, what's that Trump thing about? What are they doing? And I have conversations. The only difference is that a lot of the words and phrases and nomenclature that we use, they understand immediately, you know. So, but you'd be amazed how many lawyers in this country have no earthly idea what really is going on here. And it's not their fault. It's just that, you know, they're making a living and they don't have time to look into it.
I have lots of lawyers on the show. And I often say that when I'm watching the 6 o'clock news, I'd like to have four or five of them sitting on the couch with me. And, you know, I say that about NFL coaches too. You know, when I'm watching an NFL game,
sure.
Why in the world did they call that play or what the, you know, I can just about imagine that you guys yell at the TV kind of as much as I do, and I'm not a lawyer, but I can figure this stuff out.
Yeah, actually, I don't watch the news. I don't watch the news for that very reason. No, I do not.
You need Xanax to get through it.
Yeah, I get most. Now, I follow because I write about fake news, as you know. So most of what I do on the fake news, I don't ever watch it live. I come back kind of post-mortem and break it down after the fact. But what I found a long time ago is I have some select places I go for news. And I get a lot of news from social media. And even then, you know, sometimes, look, anybody can be wrong. I can be wrong, been wrong before. I'll be wrong again. But I've got some news sources I go to that are generally, you know, working hard to be accurate. Mm-hmm. And I stay abreast of, you know,
local news,
national news, and international news that way. And that way I don't have those episodes you're talking about where I smash my big screen TV.
Yeah, don't do that. Daniel Street, I'm going to have you back because, you know, we're in the beginnings of this whole thing. And this will be with us for a while. So I appreciate you contributing some thought to this. So as this goes on for the next couple of weeks, my listeners are going to be very appreciative of your contribution. So thank you, Mr. Daniel Street. And ladies and gentlemen, there's more coming your way after the break. Stay with us.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy. You know what? We should make an emergency communication plan. That way we're ready this year. At my dorm, we have emergency kits for earthquakes and wildfires, but I'm sure there's something more local I can send you with a link.
Okay.
Smart.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Thanks, ladies and gentlemen, for staying with us here on the Denise Simon Experience. I want to introduce you to Julie Belling. She is the writer and director of a brand new documentary about to be released, titled Beneath Sheep's Clothing. It is a communist takeover of the culture in today's America, and indeed so. In fact, I was actually thinking about all those things this morning. The list is very long. Congratulations and thanks for the great work on this. It's probably something you didn't want to do, Julie, but it's something that you almost had to do. Is that right?
Most definitely. Yeah. It goes back to, I was a missionary in Russia in the late 90s.
Oh.
And then I came back to the States and went to graduate school and studied Russian language and literature and Russian and East European studies. And I wrote my master's thesis on underground Christian movements in the Soviet Union, their survival tactics, and the tactics of the Soviet state to try to dismantle Christianity. And then I started seeing the same things happening in America, the same exact tactics. That's the foundation for the book, Beneath Sheep's Clothing, as well as the film.
This has kind of been a slow process. And I think when things happen in kind of little tiny snippets, people might raise an eyebrow, but they really don't understand the volume of it all and how it's happened.
Right.
And they almost don't feel the pain, right?
Right. And also, I mean, America, they specifically an education on what communism is and what it does has been left out of our curricula. So most of us, myself included, did not learn about communism growing up in school and did not understand what it is. Plus, the variety of communism that has overtaken our culture here in America, it doesn't look exactly like the communism in other nations because communism mutates to take over its host where whatever society it is. And it differs from society to society.
Well, give a hat tip to Governor DeSantis.
Absolutely.
He has just now signed legislation that it will be, communism will be taught in the public school systems in the state of Florida.
Yeah.
And he's not holding back. He is going to ensure that the syllabus is very robust. It's very stout. And I think... Maybe I'll see if I can contact a local high school here in Florida to see if I can go attend it myself because I'm not sure that we were ever taught. And I'm old. Is that right?
Well, I don't know how old you are, but this communist takeover of culture has been going on for a century here in America.
If we were to ask, any 100 people of various ages, various locations, what communism is, do you think they could actually define it?
Most people have a vague understanding of communism as something that's economic. And, and then also even people who do study communism, there's several different definitions. And the economic part is really only one small part of it. So I like to define Marxism, which I think is easier to define. And Marxism is a playbook that is that harnesses oppressed versus oppressor to rile up the oppressed class to anger and grievance, so they will tear down the oppressor class. And in that vacuum, the communists can come in and set up their tyrannical rule. And that the fruits of communism are impoverishment, enslavement, and death. That's the key part that Americans need to understand. It promises really nice things. It promises that they're going to uplift the underprivileged. There's promises of everyone's going to have a piece of the pie. But in the end, everyone is equally impoverished. There's impoverishment, enslavement, and death on a mass scale, unlike any other system of government the world's ever seen.
We have the progressives that are, I mean, we're throwing around words now if in discussions and in on cable news and whatnot. They're saying things like dictators and tyrants and, you know, regardless of necessarily, you know, what particular issue they're trying to explain. But we're using words today in public discourse that we've really never had to use in the last, you know, it's happened in the last 10 years, but prior to that, we really never used them. Isn't that right? I mean,
yes. And communists love to take words that people think know what they mean and actually have their own, they have their own definition. Yeah.
This has been going on for a long time, as we just mentioned. But I think that if once people realize what they're kind of living in, are they going to be shocked, or are they just going to go, oh, well?
Well, if it's allowed to proceed to its fullness, if this Marxist revolution in America is allowed to just keep proceeding, what ends up happening is mass execution. So I don't think most people would be on board with that. Even the students who are now protesting on behalf of the, you know, Palestinians, I don't think even most of them would be up for that. Only the sociopaths are down with mass execution. Mm-hmm. So the problem is waking up enough of the populace to truly understand what communism is, what it does, how it's here, and to, so we can stop it, which we can. We still have time for that, but we don't have much time.
There was a time in our history that our leaders really fought hard against communism, not only inside the United States, but any place that was close to our shores.
Correct.
We fought a very long, nasty war in Vietnam, but we didn't get anywhere because they changed up the rules of engagement.
Right.
And so since then, it's kind of come that we've just accepted that that's going to happen in these places, and we can't be the world's police. I get told that, Julie, all the time. Mm-hmm. We can't be the world's police. But right. I don't see France stepping up. I don't see Italy stepping up. You know, Germany, Britain. It's kind of like, where is everybody? Help me with that, Julie.
Well, I mean, when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, you know, America and the West sighed a collective breath of relief, like, oh my gosh, okay, communism, you know,
we can
is defeated.
Mm-hmm.
How, you know, and really and truly, though, like, and this surprised me when I was finishing my book and putting a few extra facts in there, that in like the early 1983, 1984, one third of the world's population lived under a Marxist-Leninist communist regime.
Wow.
One third of the world was in abject tyranny. And so yes, there was a sigh of relief when the behemoth Soviet Union collapsed. Some people have a theory that the communists just went underground in Russia and that they're still running things from behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. I have not done the research, the primary research on that, to have a definitive opinion. However, I do believe that our number one thing that we need to be doing here in America is to understand the communism that's not at our doorstep. It's it's been here, and it's now in the end stages of a takeover. It's in the end stages of a takeover of the culture. They have our children. If our children go to a university or a school, unless it's a very unique private school here in America, they have most of our children. They are subverting our children. Unless that is changed very quickly or interrupted, I homeschool. I have a 9-year-old son who I homeschool for this reason. Unless we interrupt this, they will have the future. And there's more to it than that, but that's really, as long as they have the children, even if, you know, DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, people roll, you know, collectively roll their eyes at that, the children are being indoctrinated to have DEI as their, which is a Marxist construct, as their foundational ideology within the schools using Maoist brainwashing techniques. The teachers themselves may not understand that's what's happening. The vast majority of them don't. However, the most effective people in America spreading communism are people who don't even understand that's what they're doing. That's why it's been so effective.
Exactly right. Does it surprise you that we have not had a single politician that has introduced legislation to eliminate communism in the United States? And if they did, would it be possible?
Well, I mean, Trump did try to ban critical race theory from the schools. He tried to make some efforts, and he has called attention to it. Obviously, Ron DeSantis, Governor DeSantis, has made some very impressive moves in Florida. Unfortunately, I live in a red state with a woke governor, and in Utah, and so we've got some serious problems here unless we can get a new governor elected this year where I live. But there's been a few, you know, Vivek Ramaswamy, who had run for president, was also calling out the communist plots by name. We really need to only be electing. This is what we actually premiered my film Beneath Sheep's Clothing here in Utah, where I live, in two locations in January, an earlier version of the film. And it was right before legislation went in here in Utah, and before they went into for action for 2024. And there were a lot of political people at my premieres, and I spoke, and I said one thing, and I'll say this to the entire, anyone listening, please hear me. Do not elect anyone into any office, whether it's local, county, state, or federal, unless they understand these Marxist agendas here in America and are committed to fighting back against them. Don't vote in someone, they're a Republican, they're a nice person, they've been in politics for 50 years, or whatever the case may be. Only elect people who understand the Marxist agendas seeking to take over our country, and they are committed to stopping them.
You know, thank you for saying that, because Saturday, I was poking around at the first 10 bills that Speaker Pelosi had introduced during her last speakership. And And
I'm sure
one,
that was nice.
Well, you know, we forget about these things. And the very first one was called H.R. 1. This was in the 117th Congress. And it was titled For the People Act of 2021. Now, it went through several committees. It went through the Intelligence Committee, the Judiciary Oversight, Science, Space, Technology, blah, 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 blah. Now, this is when the Democrats had control. It passed the House, but never passed the Senate. But what was in it? It's actually, the summary, it says, this bill addresses voter access, election integrity and security, campaign finance, and ethics for all three branches of government. So what it was really doing was nationalizing the election process. It was federalizing them. And I tried to, I didn't get a lot of time. I had some interruptions on Saturday as I was trying to do this. But these first 10 bills, if you actually look at them all carefully, it is communism. When you federalize, you know what I'm saying? And so it's almost as though, come on, people. You know, these lawmakers and these caucuses in Congress have a whole pile of attorneys. In fact, a lot of these lawmakers are the attorneys themselves, but they have people on staff, and then they that are lawyers, and then the caucuses have lawyers, and they're supposed to run things through to see if they're even constitutional. H.R. 1 is just simply not constitutional. So the question is, who gave a wink and nod, and then how did it ever pass the House? And so, as you say, I mean, it's inside the wire here. And I think all you have to do is look at those first 10 bills. Of course, not all of them, you know, went anywhere. But that's their playbook. That's the left's playbook. And so if you look at all things Moscow and Kremlin, if you look at all things Beijing in China, if you look at Tehran, if you look at North Korea, it's exactly the same thing, is it not, Julie? Or am I just being overly aggressive?
No, I don't think so. So another hallmark of communism, and it's also a hallmark of other tyrannies, but it's the consolidation of power. And communism is really the maximum consolidation and centralization of power, which is the opposite of what the founding fathers set us up, you know, with this constitutional republic, which spread out and separated powers to minimize chances of tyranny. When power is maximally consolidated, of course, that's the maximal opportunity for tyranny to take over. We should be very aware of that.
If we were to say that those lawmakers that voted for H.R. 1, including Pelosi herself, that's communism, I don't think there'd be any shame in that, would you?
No.
They have no shame.
No. No, and we don't have time, you know, we don't have time to sit around and wait and see how things will turn out. Unless enough Americans wake up and stand up and say, we're not doing this anymore, we actually know how things will turn out. It's the way that it turns out in every nation where communism takes hold. And it's not pretty. And
well,
it's tyranny,
it's
for our children, tyranny
for us. Sabotage all the way up and down the line. I don't know how else to put it. It's just sabotage. And the only thing that we have is the Constitution. Literally is the protection. And we're finding that we've got federal institutions that don't care that we have that protection. And I think that probably scares me more than anything else. They've kind of eliminated those protections, correct?
Yeah. I mean, one of the safeguards that I keep hearing about, and I was actually just at a conference last week for it, is about the power of county sheriffs and how the county sheriff, if you have a county sheriff who is a constitutional sheriff, that and the person could even be a Democrat, but if they're a constitutional sheriff that will only enforce laws, they will not enforce federal laws that are not constitutional. Mm-hmm. That is one protection.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the protection that I talk about in Beneath Sheep's Clothing is the people of the populace who stand up and say, we're not doing this I don't feel like I have a whole bunch of control over what happens in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of a takeover of culture, I can have a say on what my 9-year-old son is exposed to and how he's educated. And then the churches, that's a whole topic. That's another can of worms that we've got to wake up our churches. And a lot of Christians are waking up, but the leadership of the churches
are not so much.
Well, just like, so one of the tactics that the Soviets used to overtake the churches there was infiltrating the churches. In the Soviet Union, they infiltrated the churches with KGB agents who went into the clergy. They would rise up to assume the highest positions of power within the churches, particularly the Russian Orthodox Church and registered churches that had basically signed on with the government that they would obey them, including they weren't allowed to bring their kids to church and teach their kids religion at home. So in America, it wasn't KGB agents necessarily infiltrating, but over a century ago, avowed communists were paid and payrolled to go in and infiltrate the seminaries of many prominent seminaries throughout America to train up up-and-coming clergy to go more towards socialism and outright communism. And we have a deeply infiltrated church here in America, our mainstream churches. We have some independent churches that are, you know, speak up. They're smaller. Mm-hmm. And the from what it looks like to me, the plan is to squash those independent churches eventually. But we need to wake up the clergy of these subverted churches. And I know there's good clergy in every church. We need to wake them up, and we need to get them to stand up. And we need Christians to understand really and truly what is the play, what is the communist playbook for overtaking Christianity. Now, listen, America was founded. The Revolutionary War, many historians believe it would not have happened had it not been for Christian pastors who decided to go and from the pulpit in their churches preach to their people that God was looked upon this idea of standing up to tyranny, the tyrannical British rule, that God approved of that. And that's what many of these pastors taught in their churches. Many historians think that the Revolutionary War would not have happened had those pastors not done that. And we need similarly today, we need pastors who will call out the communism and go back to constitutional roots.
You know, we have things like against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I've had mm-hmm. various guests of various, you know, resumes and backgrounds on the show. And I've always asked the question, what is a domestic enemy? And I never really get that answer. We're not sure that we necessarily know what that is anymore, do we?
Well, I'll lay out for you. There's five types of communist enablers that are enabling the communist agendas here in America. And, you know, we don't want to like put them all in jail, but let's see here what we have. Some of them might need to go to jail. At the very top, it's like a pyramid. You have your money bags and the puppet masters. And these are big money owners. Back in the day, it was like Rockefeller Foundation, Carnegie Foundation. It still mm-hmm. is, but you've got more Bill Gates. You got other people. These people are not communists themselves, but they understand that, well, they want to maintain their power. They want to consolidate their power. And the communist playbook is a really handy way for them to keep the masses down and keep themselves above the masses, so they and their posterity can rule generation after generation. So that's one tiny part of it. The next level down, you have the avowed communists. That's also a very small group of people, the people who are openly communist here in America. There's not a ton of them. Okay, so if you just look at the avowed communists, it looks like communism isn't a problem. But here's the next level down. This one's a real big problem. It's the fellow travelers with communists. Mm-hmm. They themselves do not consider themselves communists. You even have Bernie Sanders in there, Democrat, socialist, whatever. These are progressives, leftists, and people who resonate with, oh, equity, yes. And they are, these. A lot of these people are elected officials all throughout America. They are enabling the communist agendas big time. Then the next huge level of people are the dupes. And I can separate them into two categories. Level one dupes are people who are like, oh yes, Black Lives Matter, I'm going to march for Black Lives Matter. And they're a good-hearted person who really just want to, they don't want Black people to be oppressed, which I completely, of course, agree with. Mm-hmm. They don't understand that the organization Black Lives Matter, you know, of course, more people understand this now, but, you know, a few years ago, many people didn't, that Black Lives Matter, the leaders themselves are Marxists. They even admit it openly. And so Black Lives Matter is a Marxist organization, and race warfare is a part of the communist playbook for America.
Yes.
And these people, you know, well-meaning people, they don't like oppression. Great. But they're enabling the Marxist agendas by falling for the lies, the nice sounding lies. And there's a ton of nice sounding lies. Then you have the level two dupes. These are people who, an even bigger group, and this is the group we need to reach first. These are people who can feel something's not right with all of this. Like, you know, why are there drag queens that want to perform for children? That's not quite right. Critical race theory, I don't think that's quite right. But they don't say anything about it. They don't want to lose their job. They don't want to be canceled. They don't want people to judge them as a bigot, a homophobe, you know, a racist and whatnot. And the so those are the levels of people that all five of them are enabling the communist agenda here in America.
The preamble has words in it that I think so many have ignored, and a lot of them you just kind of mentioned. Ensure domestic tranquility. And I haven't heard anybody really use those words, domestic tranquility. And secure the blessings of liberty. And way down to the county level, we don't even have blessings of liberty.
Well, here's what's happened. Listen, the communists got control of the schools decades ago. They got control of the universities first, then they got the colleges of education, then they got the teachers, and then the teachers have done the job of subverting the children to make them want socialism. And how many younger people in America demand they want socialism? Because it's not nice. It's not nice for some people to have more than others. They want the health care for everyone. They want housing, guaranteed health care, guaranteed housing, guaranteed job. That is part, that's what they did in the Soviet Union. That's communism. America, we have guaranteed freedoms and the right to pursue happiness. We don't have, it's not supposed to be guaranteed housing, guaranteed health care. Now, people, especially, you know, whether they're Christian or not, should want to help the underprivileged. And that has taken place in America more than any place else, where people are like, sure, you know, there's charitable work, because we don't want people dying in the streets who can't afford health care. So, but to make the guaranteed health care and the housing and the food and everything else, that is socialism, which is, you know, one step away from communism.
Julie, tell us when your documentary comes out, where do we see it?
Yeah, well, people can go to beneathsheepsclothing.movie and watch the trailer and get on. I think you can pre-order tickets now, and you can get on my newsletter list as well to be given email updates. The film is slated to be released on May 23rd. And when you purchase a ticket from beneathsheepsclothing.movie, we will actually stream it from beneathsheepsclothing.movie. It will also be available starting May 23rd on Rumble as a pay-per-view. And it'll be available anywhere people have the internet.
Well, I'm sad that you had to do this, but I'm happy that you had to do this, because I think it is... It's really a time for anybody at any age, at any place across the country or across the globe to be taught and in some cases retaught or reminded of where we are. So, I mean, you've really done a public service here. And I know that I often say to people, you know, take one issue a week, study it hard. And you know, do something as much as you can about it. That means that you can address 52 things in a year. So here's one of them. Beneath Sheep's Clothing. Julie Mayling, I so appreciate this conversation, and I so am grateful of the work that you've done on this. And
thank you.
I wish you an awful lot of success, but more than that, you've opened the door for us so we can all be successful along with the success of Beneath Sheep's Clothing. So, Julie, thanks so much for this conversation and your dedication to this topic. It's just huge for us. And
thank you. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks for joining us. Ladies and gentlemen, there's more coming your way on the Dedee Simon Experience. Stay with me.
The conversation starter. This is Talk 92.1 WDDQ 8L Valdosta.